You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 14th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, staff writer at The Atlantic, author of the narrative nonfiction book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America, Clint Smith will be joining us. Also, Joe Biden at the G7 in Europe meets with Putin. Speaking of the G7, it agrees on a 1 billion dose vaccine pledge to poorer, low-income nations across the world, leaving us just shy, just 10 billion vaccine doses shy of where we need to be. Meanwhile, the DOJ announces it will ramp up voting rights enforcement, but will it be enough without new law? Trump DOJ subpoenaed Apple to give up information on Trump's very own lawyer. And bye-bye, BB. But will it be frying pan into the fire with new Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett? George W. Bush judge in Wisconsin halts the USDA debt relief payments to black farmers. Pro-democracy groups offer a warning. Keiko Fujimori's election steal attempts from Pedro Castillo. Senator Ron Johnson suspended by YouTube for still promoting hydroxychloroquine. Remember that, oldie? And latest report, nearly all people hospitalized for COVID now are unvaccinated. Probably just a coincidence. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us today. Starting the week off a little bit early on Monday, just because that's our new up and atom spirit that we have around here. Emma Viglin, I'm glad you seem to have that up and atom spirit today.
Yeah, I'm energized.
Yeah.
Love Mondays.
Mondays are great. Mondays
especially
are great
when we start early.
Yes, exactly.
I'm actually doing all right, though.
What we're going to do is we're just going to dial this back, and we're just going to keep starting earlier and earlier. And the idea is that
until
we're gonna
quit.
Until we're all gone. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are still in the midst. Joe Biden is, of course, in Europe now. And in his absence, and, you know, it occurred to me that maybe this isn't quite a coincidence. The administration knew that it was heading out of town for these European talks with the G7, and they want the momentum, or the lack of momentum, I guess, for the infrastructure bill to continue on. So why not leave it with 10 senators, five Republicans, five Democrats, who, of course, don't have the ability to pass anything, because we need 10 Republicans to sign on to anything without a filibuster reform. So, I mean, it really seems to be, I don't know, like theater, maybe, is that the word I'm looking for? Or just a huge waste of time?
Or, you know, self-congratulatory, masturbatory nonsense, that as well.
There, I think that's all rolled into it. I mean, that's not necessarily the image that I wanted to sort of put out there, but if that works as well, And so we have a gang of 10, and I think I mentioned this on Friday. The Adam Gentleson had a great tweet thread about this. He's the guy who wrote the book about the filibuster and giving a sort of a brief history of gangs of, and it never works out well for the Democrats. It never works out well. Hopefully, and I don't know how this one, I mean, you know, like I say, the idea that there's going to be five other Republican senators, in addition to the five who agree with whatever they come up with, that are going to vote for this bill, just seems to me to be absolute nonsense. I find it hard to believe that all five of these Republicans who are negotiating, even if they sign off on it, are actually would ever vote for it. So, on some level, this is just like filler. And maybe that filler makes some sense insofar as, you know, Joe Biden's out of town. But hopefully, and Chuck Schumer has said this, that the reconciliation track is still going forward, which means that in the Senate committees, they are hammering out how they would expend. And we don't know what the final number would be, but presumably it should be the $2.3 trillion that Biden presented initially, because if it's just going to be Democrats, the only person you're going to have to massage, as it were, Joe Manchin, maybe Mark Kelly, Mark Warner, and maybe Kyrsten Sinema. And so hopefully we have these committees are working on how they would spend their various silos of dollars. But we will get a better sense of that probably next week. This week, we're just going to hear stories about how, you know, these 10 senators are coming close to an agreement. Here is Susan Collins. She is on, what was the show this weekend?
Face the Nation.
Face the Nation, I think it was. And here is just, I don't even know what to call this. A fascinating admission as to who pays her bills, or just sort of just one of the most bizarre reasonings that I'm surprised this guy Dickerson, who's hosting, doesn't fall out of his chair when he hears this.
And what about the sticky question of how to pay for all of this? Where does it? I've heard there's reports that it might include a gas tax increase.
There won't be a gas tax increase, and we won't be undoing the 2017 tax reform bill. Let me talk about three of the pay-fors. One is the implementation of an infrastructure financing authority. That's very similar to the state revolving funds that we use for sewer and water projects, and it's a bipartisan proposal that was first put forth by Senators Mark Warner and Roy Blunt. A second would be to repurpose some of the COVID funding that has not been spent. In the $1.9 trillion package that was enacted in March, there were restrictions on what the funding could be used for. It could be used for water, sewer, and broadband. We would make it more flexible so it could be used for infrastructure projects. And third, there would be a provision for electric vehicles to pay their fair share of using our roads and bridges. Right now, they are literally free riders because they're not paying any gas tax. So those are three of the provisions that we've taken a look at.
She sounds like she's been struck by lightning.
Well, what surprises me is that Dickerson is not struck by lightning at that point. Because I just want to make it clear what she's suggesting here. We would absolutely not tax gas. Gas being a fossil fuel, which is maybe she's not aware of in Maine, although some of their growing zones have literally changed over the past 20 years. They've gotten warmer. I mean, like, they can't produce the same amount of maple syrup because of something called climate change, which right. You may be familiar with. So we would not raise the gas tax. We would raise an electric car tax. which incidentally, electric cars is one of the ways that we would fight climate change.
Yeah.
I'm talking not to you remedially like this, because you know this, but I am talking to whoever needs to hear this so that one of our senators can find out.
But I mean, part of this, though, is just what does this process even mean? I mean, like, why are we even having her on Sunday talk shows to talk about the pay-fors and what makes up the content of this fantasy bill? I mean, this is a process that is going to evaporate within 2 or 3 weeks. There's going to be nothing that comes of it. It's only just a way for the Collinses and the Murkowskis and the Romneys and the Sinemas to get their faces out there and perform bipartisanship when this is not going to go anywhere, since we already know that Biden has ended negotiations with the Republicans. End of story.
Well, and it's almost worse than that, too, because on some level, it really obscures what the dynamic is in Washington. And so it's not necessarily helpful as a political matter for Democrats, broadly speaking. It is not terribly helpful for the public to get this misunderstanding of what is going on. And so it is the worst of all possible worlds.
It's theater to uphold this mythology of bipartisanship that upholds senators like her.
Yes, it's absurd. And, you know,
it's a self-licking ice cream cone. It's amazing
on some level. But it'll be interesting to see, like, you know, wait. So what happens? We bring up this bill and the Republicans shoot it down, and then we go into reconciliation. I mean, if that's what it takes, then that's what it takes. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Clint Smith, staff writer at The Atlantic, author of How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. We'll be right back after this. Folks, today's show is sponsored in part by Liquid IV.
Oh, my favorite. I just ran out of the acai.
Oh, that's well.
I saw we may have an extra package there. I was going to.
You can take the acai. I am now either the matcha or the tangerine immune support. And
we know.
Pear. They have pear.
What about pina colada, huh?
And pina colada.
Yeah.
When you push your body hard or you just feel run down, it's important to take care of yourself. I think you know that, Emma. You got to do so with proper vitamins and nutrients. How do you do so? How do you get your body to absorb that stuff? Liquid IV. They created Hydration Multiplier Plus Immune Support to maintain and strengthen your immune system. Hydration Multiplier Plus Immune Support is a cutting-edge blend of vitamin C, zinc, and Wellmune in a convenient single-serving package to help strengthen your immune system. This is the one that I have been a regular of recently. Tangerine. I go through cycles. Tangerine. Zinc supports your immune cell health and function. Wellmune is a naturally sourced beta-glucan that's proven to help strengthen your immune system. Each packet has, like I say, that natural tangerine flavor. It tastes so good, and it does. Liquid IV can provide 2 to 3 times more hydration than water alone. The blend is powered by cellular transport technology designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other nutrients. Plus, side bonus, the company has donated over 4 million servings in response to COVID-19. Products are being donated to hospitals. They're being donated to first responders, food banks, more. Folks, back when I used to travel, and hopefully again soon, I would always take half a dozen packets in my bag so I don't get any jet lag, or sometimes I get dehydrated when I take a plane. And occasionally when I have a day where I've overindulged, or an evening where I've overindulged, if I'm smart, I take one at
Saturday.
Night.
Yeah.
And then I'll have one in the morning, and it is extremely helpful in that regard. And when I feel like I'm getting a little sick or run down. And then, of course, on a daily basis, I substitute the matcha for coffee. And so I get that energy boost.
Nice.
Yep. I like it. I'm very happy with it, actually. It's my new regimen. It's important to have those type of things. Folks, get your Liquid IV Hydration Multiplier Plus Immune Support in bulk at Costco, or order online. Get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MAJORITYREP. A checkout. That's 25% off anything you order when you get better hydration today using promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. Many times I have told you the best time to look for new employees when you don't need one. And ZipRecruiter makes it so easy. If you're a business owner who's hiring, you probably face a lot of challenges when it comes to finding the right person for your role. Believe me, I know it. That's why hiring can feel like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Well, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope that the right person bumps into it. That's why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent out to over the 100 top job sites. One click. And ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills, right experience, specifically for your job, and then actively invites them to apply. Correct, Brendan? That's what happened to Brendan. That's how we got Brendan here. In fact, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. We got a bunch of very quality people. Just Brendan was literally like genetically designed to do that job. With all due respect, Brendan, I know you have another life besides here, but and it's no wonder over 2.3 million businesses have come to ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. So listen, while other companies overwhelm you with way too many options, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for, the needle in the haystack. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Once again, remember to go to this unique place, ZipRecruiter.com/M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y, majority. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And lastly, we all shop online. We've done it a lot, over COVID. A lot of people, we're going to continue to do it. I did it beforehand too. I've told you the many stories about how I sat my daughter down when she was of age and had the talk, which was you never not search for a coupon code.
Yes.
Because when you're buying something online. And then I had to give her another talk, which is here is an applet. It's like something you put, an extension you put into your browser, and it's called Honey. And thanks to Honey, you no longer have to manually search for coupon codes. That is a thing of the past.
Very nice.
Yes. The look on my daughter's face when I told her that, she was very excited. Honey is the free shopping tool that scours the internet for promo codes, and it applies the best one and inserts it into your cart. It supports over 30,000 stores online, ranging from sites that have tech and gaming products to fashion brands, food delivery even, apparently. I don't do food delivery online. I'm afraid of doing that because I don't know why. But Imagine you're shopping at one of your favorite sites. This is what happens. When you go to checkout, the Honey button drops down on the right-hand side of your upper right-hand side.
I know. I have it in my browser.
It says all you got to do, you click apply coupons. You wait a few seconds. Honey searches the coupons it can find for that site. And if it finds a working coupon, you'll watch the prices drop. It has found over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. I saved $5 on a pair of shorts the other day. But here's the part that is going to seem weird to people. Mm-hmm. I also saved a buck or two on some cables that I bought for the office. But I mean, I recently bought a couch. And here's the part that I like about it. And this is going to seem weird. It will tell you that there are no coupons. FOMO. That's my biggest concern. Did I just buy something and lose out on a 5 or 10% coupon?
Right.
Well, with Honey, one of the things that I like about it is that it actually tells me, no, Sam, you have not missed out. So you can enjoy your product without feeling like you blew it. Because you can't go backwards. So if you don't already have Honey,
it's like a coupon in and of itself.
That's what I'm saying. Peace of mind. That's priceless. I know that's a weird thing to like about it. Right? Honestly, it's like
you'd
it's almost
have a piece of
I mind. Mean, I like to get in the coupon. Of course, I like to get in the coupon. I like to save $5, but I also like to know that I'm not missing up an opportunity to save $5. If you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free savings. It's literally free and installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you're doing yourself a solid. You're also supporting this podcast. I would never recommend something I don't use. I think you know that, folks. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. And once again, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you support the free show and you get the free show free of commercials. All right. Want to welcome to the program staff writer at The Atlantic, author of the new narrative nonfiction book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with History, with the History of Slavery Across America, Clint Smith. Welcome to the program. Do we have him? Oh, there he is.
Hey there.
Clint, welcome to the program. We have Emma Vigeland here as well.
How are you all?
Doing well. Thanks for being here, Clint.
Thanks for joining us. You know, you're, to a certain extent, I mean, this may be completely far out of field, but there was a quality of your book that, and it was far more deliberate, but it reminded me of this movie, this documentary from like 30 years ago called Sherman's March by Ross McElwee, a documentary filmmaker up at Harvard who went off to do Sherman's March and then ended up just talking about the world in general. And I think on some level, what's interesting about your book to me is it is both an exploration of history and the massive absence of this history. You went to 8 different sites. I think you went to more, but you ended up writing about 8. Just what was the idea behind why did you decide to write this book and in particular like the way you did write it?
Yeah, so this book began in May 2017 when I was watching the statues of several Confederate statues come down in my hometown in New Orleans. So I was watching statues of Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis, P.G.T. Beauregard, all leaders in the Confederacy, be taken down. And I was wondering what it meant that I grew up in a majority Black city in which there were more homages to enslavers than there were to enslaved people. And what does it mean that to get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard? To get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Highway? That my middle school was named after a leader of the Confederacy? That to this day, my parents live on a street named after somebody who owned 150 enslaved people? Because the thing about monuments and memorials and iconography is that, and symbols, is that they're not just symbols. They are reflective of the stories that societies tell, and those stories embed themselves into the narratives communities carry, and those narratives shape public policy, and public policy shapes the material conditions of people's lives, which isn't to say that taking down a 60-foot tall statue of Robert E. Lee is going to erase the racial wealth gap, but it is to say that it is part of it is one part of a larger ecosystem of stories and ideas that shape how we understand what has happened to certain communities and what needs to be accounted for and what needs to be amended to repair the harm that has been done to different communities across generations. And so I started getting obsessed with how slavery was remembered or misremembered in New Orleans, and then sort of expanded it out to think about how it was remembered or misremembered across the country, and ultimately wanted to go to different places that represented the sort of patchwork of memory and the patchwork of experiences that are reflective of how of the inconsistent way that this country memorializes slavery.
I have become we're sort of in a period, it seems to me, of a like a corrective period about that history just seemingly being more present, and maybe we can talk about maybe why that is. We're going through this period, and certainly I feel like in my education, you know, like it just seems like I learned nothing. You know, I wasn't necessarily a bad student. I wasn't necessarily a good student, but it just seemed to be available at the time. But I wonder, like, on that primary question, like, as you grew up in that context, in the shadow of all these homages to enslavers, like, was there consciousness of that? I mean, you individually or just like with your friends? I mean, did it occur to anybody to say like, hey, wait a second, what? That's really messed up. Like, I'm just trying to think, like, if I walked down the street and it was like, you know, I'm just going down Goebbels Avenue, and one day it occurs to me, like, wait a second, there's a, you know, I have some history with that guy a little bit. Was there a level of consciousness about that? Or
I think part of the insidiousness of the success of the Lost Cause project, and the success of a history of white supremacy attempting to distort and manipulate history more generally, is that I didn't really have any consciousness of what those statues were, what they represented. You know, I think all the time about how the statue of P.G.T. Beauregard sits in the, you know, in front of City Park, where I would go and like feed the ducks and the geese with my mom on the weekends, and that I was literally, you know, feeding the ducks under the statue of a man who ordered the first attack that opened the Civil War. But I had no conception of who that person was. He was part of, he felt like he was just part of what ornamented the entire city, which are these statues of white men on pedestals. And so it wasn't until my adulthood that I feel like I gained a more acute understanding of who these people were and what they stood for. And part of the thing is that part of what white supremacy attempts to do is take empirical statements and turn them into ideological ones, right? So if I say the Confederacy was a treasonous territory that seceded from the Union and raised an army predicated on maintaining and expanding the institution of slavery, from in a lot of circles, that would be perceived as an ideological statement. And if I'm in a classroom, that would be perceived as me attempting to indoctrinate students with my political beliefs, when it's actually just reflective of the empirical and historical evidence that we have, right? Like the Confederacy said it for themselves. They, if you look at the declarations of Confederate secession in 1861, they say it. A state like Mississippi says, quote, "Our position is thoroughly aligned with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interests of the world." All right. So they were not vague about why they were seceding from the Union. They were quite clear about it. But part of what has happened over the course of more than a century now is that those stories and that sort of evidence, that sort of primary source evidence, is not presented to students. And so the narrative of the Confederacy being this thing that was just fighting for states' rights, or Robert E. Lee being an honorable man who was just doing right by his community, or that this war was a war of Northern aggression rather than one that was predicated on these folks leaving the country in order to sustain this abominable social and economic practice, it gets muddled, right? It becomes a sort of Orwellian thing where it's not even meant to make turn everybody into racist. It's just meant to make people confused, to the point where in 2018, you have a study from the Southern Poverty Law Center that shows that only 8% of U.S. high school seniors are able to identify slavery as the central cause of the Civil War, because we our teaching around it has been so, people are either scared to address it at all, right, for fear that something will happen. And I think we see in state legislatures across the country an intentional effort to amplify and magnify that chilling effect, to make teachers scared to even touch this stuff, so that you continue to have young people growing up with a skewed sense of what the Confederacy was, what slavery was, and thus how it has shaped the social, economic, and political landscape of our country today.
Well, part of this, too, I would say, is like it goes deeper than just, I think, the Civil War as well, right? I mean, there's this concept of Thomas Jefferson, you write about the with Monticello, about how there's a quote from someone who took the tour that says this really took the shine off of our guy, because it's about this greater American mythology, mm-hmm, that upholds then secondarily the conversation that we're talking about, the Civil War, right? I mean, can you just talk about the deeper roots of how we fetishize, mythologize, whatever you want to say, our founding fathers? It is rooted in American exceptionalism and white supremacy. And then, of course, it's at its starkest in the way that we learn about the Civil War.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first chapter of the book is about Monticello. And I wanted to go to Monticello specifically because Jefferson is such a fascinating historical character to me, in the sense that I think he personifies so many of the complexities and contradictions and the sort of cognitive dissonance of this country's history, which is to say that this America is a place that has provided unparalleled, unimaginable opportunities for millions of people across generations to achieve wealth accumulation and upward mobility in ways that their ancestors could have never imagined. And it has done so at the direct expense of millions and millions of other people who've been intergenerationally subjugated and oppressed to create that wealth and opportunity for the other group. And so both of those things are the story of America. And you have to hold the sort of duality of both of those things in order to understand the duality of this country. And Jefferson, similarly, I think, again, embodies that, where he is someone who wrote one of the most important documents in the history of the Western world, and also enslaved over 600 people over the course of his lifetime, including four of his own children that he had by an enslaved woman, Sally Hemings. He wrote in one document that All Men Are Created Equal and wrote in another document that Black people are inferior to whites, quote, in both endowments of body and mind. And so when I go to a place like Monticello, part of what I'm trying to understand is how does an institution that is in many ways dedicated to preserving the memory and legacy of this person preserve an honest legacy of all of who he was? And not only in preserving that space, Monticello, recognizing that Monticello didn't just belong to Jefferson, but also the hundreds of enslaved people who lived there across generations, who in many ways that land belonged to even more so than it does to Jefferson, because Jefferson was in Paris, in D.C., in Philadelphia, in New York for significant stretches of time. And it was these enslaved families, the Hemingses, the Fawcetts, the Grangers, who cultivated that land, who built memories on that land, who created community on that land. And so in order to understand, again, to your point, like why our country looks the way that it does today, we have to understand the nature of how the people who created the social contract upon which this country was founded, who they wanted to include in as the beneficiaries of that social contract, and who they imagined being the people who were going to be exploited to make those benefits possible for others.
And speaking of that exploitation, what is also, I think, sort of fascinating about that is that, you know, he as a farmer would have no time to do that. We're not I never hear it anymore, but as a kid, I remember, you know, there was like this saying, like behind every great man is a great woman or a strong woman or something like that. But
I reject that cheesy statement.
But the interesting thing is like, you know, behind every guy who had the time to draft a constitution for is, you know, 500 slaves essentially who were financing this guy's being able to have all this time to think. And that was really striking, like that concept. And that is not in any way communicated, I think. Well, I mean. So let's also talk about that, the concept of you, like, you could have just written about these places without sort of assessing how people who are learning these things for the first time or you know, were absorbing them. I mean, talk about that dynamic where you're interviewing people as as the shine comes off of Jefferson a little bit.
Yeah, so... two of the people that I interviewed were women named Donna and Grace. And so Monticello is interesting because I think it represents a place that evolves in the way that it is told, has evolved in the way that it is told the story of that place and of Jefferson. So, you know, you talk to people who went there 30, 20, 10 years ago, their experience at Monticello is very different from what I experienced when I went there in 2018, where now they have a tour dedicated to the Hemings family. They have a tour specifically about the history of slavery at Monticello. But some critique of it is that all of these tours are separate tours, right? And that there's the primary house tour in which somebody, you know, I went on the house tour and I went on the slavery at Monticello tour. And on the house tour, there wasn't really a lot of discussion about Jefferson as an enslaver. It might've been mentioned, but to your point that I think is really important is that like nothing, you know, Jefferson was a very smart person and had a range of interests, philosophical, scientific, geographic. I mean, he, you know, his mind was sort of everywhere, but he only had the time to pursue those interests, to write these letters, to explore these ideas because of the labor of hundreds of enslaved people who did that. And so I was on the slavery at Monticello tour, and Donna and Grace were clearly being unsettled by so much of what they were hearing from our guide, a guy named David Thorson. And David, you know, as I mentioned in the book, in the span of 45 minutes to an hour, was more direct and honest about Jefferson and his relationship to slavery in ways that I was like, why didn't I learn this in eighth grade social studies class? Like, this should have been central to my understanding of this. But they were, but I was familiar with the information, and these women, from what I could tell on their faces, clearly weren't. So I went up to them after and was talking to them, and they were just like, I had no idea that Jefferson was a slave owner. I had no idea that Monticello was a plantation. And mind you, these are folks who like bought plane tickets, rented a car, got a hotel room, and like came to this place as a sort of pilgrimage to honor and to see the home of one of our founding fathers and the third president of the United States, and who had no idea that he enslaved human beings. And I think that that is a sort of microcosm of the failure of how slavery is taught across this country, in which you could have people who came to this place to pay tribute to this man and who had no idea what this place actually was and who this man and what this man did to people on this land. And I think it was an important reminder for me, because I think in the worlds that I move in, everybody's like, oh, Jefferson was an enslaver. Like, he's a hypocrite. He was more full of moral contradictions. Like, that is how we understand who Jefferson was. But there are a lot of people who just don't know a lot of information, and not just about Jefferson, but about slavery writ large. And that is, again, intentional. It is the result of an mid 19th century effort after the Civil War to prevent us from having a collective understanding of what slavery was. And most people don't realize that it wasn't until the mid 20th century, during the Civil Rights Movement, that the narrative around slavery began to shift. Like, it wasn't until the work of historians like Kenneth Stamp and others, and that his work gained mainstream popularity because of the work of activists and civil rights leaders, that the understanding of slavery began to shift toward, like, oh, this was a horrific, cruel, abominable institution. Because until the mid 20th century, the popular narrative around it collectively in this country was that it was a civilizing institution. Ulrich B. Phillips, the predominant historian who propagated this idea, talked about plantations as these places that civilized Africans from the savage era of Africa. As the late Senator John Calhoun from South Carolina, you know, he would always talk about slavery as a positive good for both Black and white alike. And that narrative was central to America's collective understanding of slavery for a century before it began to shift. And we're still attempting to sort of unwind so much of that.
That dynamic I just find fascinating. And I guess, I mean, it's sort of obvious on some level, like why it was, why so many participated in that sort of, I guess, mystification of our history, because it served their power interests, right? I mean, and it sort of kicked off, you know, during Reconstruction with a lot of, like, literal massacres to make sure that that they were in charge of those things. Let's talk about the next place you write about, and I wonder, like, you know, you go from Monticello to the Whitney Plantation, then to the Angola prison, a cemetery, Blanford Cemetery, that is of Confederate soldiers, then to Galveston Island, where sort of the birthplace of Juneteenth, up to New York City, and then to Senegal at Gori Island. What was it? How did you want to order this? Like, was there a specific, I mean, you obviously went to a bunch of different places, but was there a specific, when you were contemplating the ordering of these things, what was behind that?
It's a great question. It's not necessarily placed in chronological order,
right?
And part of what I wanted to do was tell what felt almost like it's not completely like this, but to some extent, like an intergenerational story of slavery and the different ways that it would manifest itself, right? So Galveston and Juneteenth comes directly after Blanford, which is a place that is focused predominantly on and thinking about the Civil War and the legacy of the Civil War. And then I begin with the two plantations, Monticello and the Whitney Plantation, and think about how those places that were central sites of enslavement in the South reckon with that history. And then go to Angola, which is a place that, you know, I could have put Angola after after Juneteenth to talk about the way that convict leasing shaped, you know, the and created the sort of afterlife of slavery, as the scholar Cydia Hartman talks about. But what I wanted to do in that instance was put Angola in conversation with the Whitney, given that they're both in Louisiana, given that they're only an hour apart from one another, given that the guy I go to Angola with, Norris Henderson, who was incarcerated at Angola for 30 years, talks about how when he goes to the Whitney, he is able to more effectively make sense of his experience at Angola. And so part of it is like trying to tell somewhat of a linear intergenerational story, but also not at the expense of being able to put things in conversation with one another that I think stand well together or are helpful for the reader and helpful for me in making sense of these things when they're side by side.
So tell us about Angola, because this is also like one of those things where I think is in somewhat analogous to the idea of like, you know, walking down, walking down the Klaus Barbie Boulevard or something on some level and going, hey, wait a second. What? Tell us about Angola prison. This is a massive, massive prison in Louisiana.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up because I think about that all the time with Angola. So Angola is the largest maximum security prison in the country. It is 18,000 acres wide, bigger than the island of Manhattan. It is a place where 75% of the people held there are black men. Over 70% of them are serving life sentences. And it is built on top of a former plantation. And what I tell people is that if you were to go to Germany and you had the largest maximum security prison in Germany, and it was built on top of a former concentration camp in which the people held there were disproportionately Jewish, that place would rightfully be a global emblem of anti-Semitism. It would be abhorrent. It would be disgusting. We would never allow a place like that to exist because it would so clearly run counter to all of our moral and ethical sensibilities. And yet here in the United States, we have the largest maximum security prison in the country where the vast majority of people held there are black men serving life sentences, working for virtually no pay on land that was once a plantation, picking crops while someone watches over them on horseback with a gun over their shoulder. And so part of what I'm exploring when I go to Angola is what are the ways that a history of white supremacy not only enacts physical violence against people's bodies, but also collectively numbs us to certain types of violences that in another global context would be wildly unacceptable. And what does it mean that that place not only is not addressing and confronting and being honest about its relationship to that history, but that that place has a gift shop in front of it. And at the gift shop in front of the prison, is there's shot glasses and baseball caps and stuffed animals and sweatshirts and coffee mugs. And on one of the coffee mugs, there's a silhouette of a watchtower. And above and below, there's text written. And it says, Angola, a gated community. And so not only is it not addressing its relationship to this history, but it's making a mockery of and belittling and making fun of the experiences of thousands of people who are still held there today, many of whom were sentenced to serve life in prison there when they were children, many of whom were sentenced by non-unanimous juries, which has since been rendered unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, right? And so, you know, I could have written a whole book about
To talk about making a mockery of it, they have, you can maybe expand on this, but they have a show where people buy tickets and they watch the people who are imprisoned, is my understanding, perform in this rodeo for like a chance at some small payout.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've not experienced the rodeo personally. I've seen a lot of footage of it and read a lot about it, but it's interesting because some people attempt to take the rodeo and they'll be like, oh, well, like the people who are participating in the rodeo, like they choose to do it. Like it's their decision. They're not being forced to do it. But the thing that you have to understand about prison is that you have so little agency and the nature of your days is full of so much monotony that you look for anything to break up the monotony of your time to give you a sense of something to look forward to, even when the thing to look forward to is dangerous and might result in you getting run over by a bull. And like there are stories of people who've broken legs, broken arms, broken their necks. But it's like if you were in a desert and somebody shows up in the desert and they have like a cup of dirty water and they're like, do you want this dirty water? You're going to be like, yeah, I want that dirty water. And it's not, and that person, it would be wrong then for somebody to be like, well, you love dirty water. You decided to drink that dirty water. So like you must like doing it. When you have limited options of ways with which to make meaning of your life or to do anything other than sit inside your cell, people grab hold of those even when it is as cruel and insidious as it is. And so I think any sort of idea of like a person making a decision to do something has to be understood in the context from which that decision is emerging.
I have to say that, like, you know, the idea that Angola is built on a plantation, it's almost like if it almost seems manufactured. Like I want to do a movie and I want to, you know, create this metaphor of, you know, sort of like what of the legacy of slavery and just how it mutates into, you know, the way that we can still maintain this type of social control and create an underclass. I have an idea. Let's situate a prison on top of a plantation. Like, I mean, it almost seems almost like fictional, like a fictional choice. Mm-hmm. Talk about Blandford Cemetery. That was not originally where you were intending to go.
It was not. And part of what I had really enjoyed about the book, I think any nonfiction writer, you know, the process is like you write a proposal and you tell the publisher, like, this is what I'm going to write about. This is the people I'm going to talk to. These are the things I'm going to do. And then, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years later, you look at your book and you're like, this is very different than what my proposal said. And especially with a book like this, where like, I literally, even in the places that I went, like I wanted to go to Monticello and I wrote about Monticello, even at a place like Monticello, so much of how I write about that place depends on the people I meet at that time, on that day, in that place, right? So it is, none of these are sort of definitive accounts of any of these places. They are reflections of my experience at each of these places at any given point in time. But Blandford, you know, I initially thought I was going to write a chapter on Civil War battlefields. And I went to this Civil War battlefield that's a national park in Petersburg, Virginia. And I went on the tour and I was like, okay, this is interesting. I think there's something here. But I was telling the tour guide, the ranger, about my project. And he was like, oh, you should go to this Confederate cemetery. It's about 10 minutes down the road. And I was like, Confederate cemetery? I mean, it's something that I would have never... There's like things you would do on your own and then things you do as a journalist. Like in my own capacity, I'd be like, there's no chance that I'm ever going to go to a Confederate cemetery. But, so you know, the journalist in me started, you know, being like, oh, okay, I think that sounds like a fascinating thing that like truly was never even on my mind as a potential possibility. And so I went, and I think, you know, I went on this tour in which they gave this tour of the church. And for context, Blandford is one of the largest Confederate cemeteries in the country, a place where the remains of 30,000 Confederate soldiers are buried. And I went on a tour of the church at the center of the cemetery, and they were pointing to all these stained glass windows and talking in intimate detail about their history. And then the tour ended, and I was like, this is bizarre that we just spent all this time talking about the beauty of these stained glass windows with saints, you know, embedded in them, and we're not talking at all about why these windows were built, like who they were built in honor of or the land that we're standing on. And literally that at the bottom of the windows it says, in honor of our brave Confederate soldiers who fought for a just cause, and different iterations of that. And so then I came back, there was a flyer inside of the visitor center. I was talking to a woman who works inside the visitor center, and there was a flyer on the desk in front of her. And we were talking, my eyes started kind of wandering, and I looked down and I was like, what is that? And then she like thrust her hand on top of it. And I was like, oh, this is strange. And I sort of could read between her fingers that it was a flyer promoting the Sons of Confederate Veterans Memorial Day celebration happening there a few weeks from then. And so I was like, well, I have to come back for this. And so I came back for the Sons of Confederate Veterans Memorial Day celebration. I was conspicuous, as you can imagine, a conspicuous presence. I went with my white friend, William. My wife wouldn't let me go by myself. She was like, you got to take your white friend. And so I was like, Billy, come on, man, we got to go to the Confederate cemetery. And so we went, and it was just so clarifying, because I was spending the day with these Sons of Confederate veterans, these United Daughters of the Confederacy, these, Confederate reenactors, neo-Confederates, kind of the whole spectrum, and having conversations with them about why they believed what they believed, you know, that slavery wasn't a central cause of the Civil War, that it was overblown, that it was the War of Northern Aggression, that the, you know, all the people buried in this Confederate cemetery were people worthy of being honored, that, you know, and the keynote speaker was Paul C. Grambling, who was at that time the commander in chief, as they call it, of the Sons Confederate Veterans. And when he was giving a speech, he said that all the people who wanted to take down the statues of Confederate leaders were the American ISIS. He's like, they're terrorists and they're trying to erase history in the same way that ISIS is in the Middle East. And we should treat them as such. And so it was just, again, clarifying to understand how the lost cause manifests itself today. Because I think for some people, you can, you know, their understanding of history is not grounded in empirical evidence or primary source documents. It is a story they have been told. And it is a story they tell. It is an heirloom that is passed down across generations. And who they understand themselves to be in the world is very much shaped by the stories they've been told by people they love, even when those stories are false.
So is that relationship that they have to the story, is it a relationship that exists to their to the people who told them it? Or is you know, like, how much of that story is also important? Like, they could have been told any story, right? And oh, you're telling me something contrary to that. That has implications to, like, my relationship with my grandfather who passed away. Like, because he's the one who told me that story. And if that story's not real, what else don't I know about him? And everything I thought about him was wrong. And that implicates that relationship, as opposed to the part of it where it's like, oh, the reality you're telling me implicates my relationship to just, like, everything around me and who I am in the world, you know, distinct from my finding out that my grandfather was sort of a fraud or whatever. It's like, how much of, what do you think that balance is there?
I think it's absolutely both. I mean, I think about a conversation I had with a guy named Jeff who told me about how when he was a kid, his grandfather would take him to the cemetery and they would sit in the gazebo at the center of the cemetery and watch at dusk as the sun would set and the deers would sort of slalom through the tombstones. And he would sing him songs that his grandfather had sang him. And he would tell him about all the people who were buried here, who were part of his community, part of his family, and how they're so misunderstood by this country and how they fought a war to protect their families and their loved ones. And that, you know, they weren't racist and slavery had nothing to do with it. And that's propaganda. And so these are the stories that Jeff grows up with. And Jeff now has his own granddaughters who he brings to the cemetery and tells the same story to. And so it very much is deeply entangled in a sort of emotional and psychological and intimate relationship that people have with the people they love who told them these stories. And we see this manifest itself not only in the Lost Cause, we see this in religion, we see this in politics, we see this in all, there are all sorts of ways that the heirloom of ideology is passed down and people either grapple with it and reject it or create nuance within it or create distinct, like, granddad is homophobic and racist and, like, you know, and you put that here and then you, like, still go to Thanksgiving dinner and you just try to keep it, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But for a lot of people, if they accept that so many of the stories the people who love them told them about who they were, who this country is, who their community is, it becomes difficult to disentangle their love for that person from the things that that person told them. And I think embedded within that is your second point of then it becomes this existential question or this existential crisis where so much of how someone has come to understand themselves in the world has been shaped by the stories that they have been told by these people who were telling lies. And so if they're going to accept that these were lies, then it shatters so much of how they have situated themselves in relationship to history, in relationship to this country, in relationship to the world. And that is a hard thing for many people to let go of. You know, one of the guys at the end of the book that I talk about said, you want me to accept that my great, great, grandfather was a monster. And for me, I'm like, I actually am not interested in the interiority of your grandfather's heart or spirit. You know, like that's kind of secondary to me. It is important that you accept that your grandfather, your great grandfather fought for a monstrous cause, right? Like there's a difference between like whether someone is a monster and the actions that they did. I mean, it's kind of the way that our understanding rightfully of how racism manifests itself is moving away from an interpersonal understanding of its manifestations to a systemic or structural one that's grounded in policy and action. So, it's if so much of who you believe yourself to be in the world is animated by things you realize are lies, then you just tell yourself that they're not lies and you say that everybody else is lying.
I almost feel like when you were saying that like we need to put an asterisk on this so that we do not fall afoul of the critical race theories that we have to I mean, to a certain extent, like that's what that whole critical race theory, I don't know, boogie man or person that is being unleashed, it feels like on some level is a reaction on to I mean, I don't know. I don't think I'm imagining that there has been a sort of revisiting of the implications of slavery over the past like 10 years or so. I mean, just in terms of like, you know, we do 5 interviews a week or 4 interviews a week. And just like the books that are coming out about, you know, the relationship of cotton to the entire country's economy, there was, you know, and there has been more sort of Reconstruction and Juneteenth, it sort of feels like it's making a little bit of a comeback. Tulsa and Charleston and all the other ones that But what do you think accounts for this? I mean, like what's happening generationally that there is space for this now? Is it just like that certain generations have died off and there's space or that there's what else do you think is happening?
I mean, I think it is mostly attributed to the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, I think in the same way that the civil rights movement completely recalibrated the way that people understood the origins of black white inequality. And lifted up an entire new generation of social historians who used history to make sense of the present, to make sense of why what we were seeing with Jim Crow, to make sense of what we were seeing with segregation, to make sense of what we were seeing with white supremacist violence. And that gave people a new understanding of the history from which it emerged. I think now, since, you know, 2012, 2013, part of what activists and organizers have done is open up space for writers and academics and journalists and artists to go back into that history to help us understand that what happened to Mike Brown, what happened to Renisha McBride, what happened to Eric Garner, what happened to, you know, the list goes on and on, with George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, they're not isolated incidents, but the context that shaped what those police departments look like, the historical context that shaped what the communities look like in which those police are operating, the context that has shaped what sort of resources communities do or don't have socially and economically, that is all part of a history that we tell ourselves was a long time ago, but it in fact wasn't that long ago at all. And part of what I want the reader to understand in this book is that we both have a physical proximity to this landscape that is profound, in which the scars of this history are all around us. You know, I wrote this book about 9 places. I could have written about 10,009. You know, it's everywhere. But not only our physical proximity, but our temporal proximity, right? That this institution existed for 250 years and has only not existed for 150. So it existed for 100 years longer than it didn't. And again, there are people who are still with us who had relationships to those who were born into bondage. The woman who opened the museum, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, in 2016 alongside the Obama family, was the daughter of an enslaved person. Like, not the granddaughter or the great-granddaughter. She was the daughter of someone who was born into slavery. And this is in 2016. My grandfather's grandfather was enslaved, right? So when I imagine my 4-year-old son sitting on my grandfather's lap, I think about my grandfather and imagine him sitting on his grandfather's lap. And I'm reminded that again, this history we tell ourselves was a long time ago, wasn't that long ago at all. And so the idea that that history, which wasn't that long ago, would have nothing to do with what our contemporary landscape of inequality looks like is morally and intellectually disingenuous. It has everything to do with it. All our political, economic, and social infrastructure has been shaped by this thing that was only a few generations ago.
And not to mention, I think one of the things your book shows too is that the elements of that institution still exist. Like the ideological framework and the understanding of the world is still being taught on some level. And so the actual dynamic of the institution doesn't exist, but sort of like the vapors of it is still sort of floating around in the air in some fashion.
Yeah. And sort of the scholar Sadia Hartman talks about it as the afterlife of slavery, right? In which, you know, if we think about prison, for example, I'm not someone who would say that prison is slavery. I think they are two phenomenologically different things and like should be interrogated on their own terms and their own precise terms, right? But certainly contemporary prisons in our contemporary carceral state carries the remnants and the residue of that history in really profound ways, and that needs to be understood and accounted for, and not just in things that are sort of self-evident like our prison system, but in, you know, our electoral college, you know, our history of gerrymandering, our the zoning policies we have, the list goes on and on and on. But ultimately you realize that the reason one community looks one way and another community looks another way is not because singularly of the people in those communities or what they have or have not done, but it's because of what has been done to those communities generation after generation after generation. And so this book is about slavery, but that's, you know, and even if we were just to account for slavery, that would be true. But then when it kept going, then with the Black codes, then with Jim Crow, then with segregation, now with redlining, and then, you know, mass incarceration, mass criminalization. So we see and continue to see different iterations of it. And part of what it, a part of what a deep understanding of history does, and part of why you have so many state-sanctioned efforts in legislatures across the country attempting to prevent teachers from teaching it, is because when you realize the history of this country can't lie to you anymore. It can't lie to you about why certain people have things and certain people don't. And you can no longer attribute it to notions of like what people morally deserve or don't deserve because they did or didn't work hard. But you understand it as being the result of, again, like state-sanctioned policies that have been enacted across generations.
Clint Smith, the book is How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Again, really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back with more. All right, folks, that is all of our show for today. If you're watching us on Peacock, which, of course, you can see this program play at 10 p.m. On Peacock. And also you can watch the other interview show that Em and I do.
Great interviews.
We could call it Reported. Yeah, we do a couple of interviews a day extra with the reporters, mostly getting reported stories. So you can check that out. So if you're leaving us, we will see you again tomorrow. And if you're staying with us, we're going to head into the fun half rather quickly. We're going to do an abbreviated fun half today. So I have some chores to do, but maybe I'll talk about that another time. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes the show possible. Thanks so much. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. All that and more. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian Media Universe.
Yeah, so tonight for Left Reckoning Patreon members, so patreon.com/Left Reckoning, Gene Bajelon, David Griscom, and I, and another, I think, professor guest brought by Gene, will be going through the 1776 Project, you know, the Trump's response to the 1619 Project, which has a lot of interesting facts about the Constitution. Like, did you know that it is important to note that by design, there's room in the Constitution for significant change and reform. Indeed, great reforms, and it lists some, like abolition, women's suffrage, and then anti-communism, the civil rights movement, and the pro-life movement.
Right.
I've often come forward to improve our dedication to the document.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's great.
We'll be discussing that. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning. That's for patrons only tonight.
Like that all rolled up into one. It's nice. Nice to, it's like a stowaway on a train or something. All right, folks, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back. Back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bang. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
What?
Come on!
What?
Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
I am a total
pussy,
total
pussy, total pussy, total pussy, total pussy, total pussy, total pussy, total pussy, total pussy.